The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we have a hands-on review of the Nexus tablet, details of the greatest British startup competition since Jon Snow presided over the eMillionaire show in 2000, and all the intel from the UK's biggest annual gaming event, Develop, held last week in Brighton. Joining me in the studio is Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. And later in the podcast, we'll hear from Keith Stewart, The Guardian's games correspondent, and Christian Donlan from Eurogamer. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Rawr. First up, let's get hands-on with some hardware. Charles, the Google tablet, the Nexus 7, arrived last week, and you've had some quality time with the product. Tell me about it.
It's a 7-inch tablet, so 7-inch on the diagonal. It's got Google's name on it that was actually manufactured by Asus. It's 16 by 10, 16 by 9-ish sort of format, so considerably longer than it is wide. Unlike the iPad, which is a 4:3 format, this is sort of much longer and thinner.
So it's the Samsung came out with their own Samsung machine. It's
pretty much all Android tablets have that same sort of 16:9, 16:10 sort of ratio, which seems to be the way that they've all gone. And as a product, I mean, it runs the latest version of Android, Jelly Bean 4.1. And
not gingerbread, not ice cream sandwich.
None of the other desserts that you're familiar with before.
Well, honestly, I know I ask this every single time. Why? Why do they do this? Why do they do it, Charles?
Why do they name it after desserts?
After desserts.
They just do. It's like Intel names theirs after rivers. Mm. They name their chips after
makes
rivers.
Makes me grumpy. I suppose more than anything, it makes me hungry. Anyway, please do continue.
And so I used it and I wrote a review of it, which is online at the Guardian's technology site. Excited some interest from various commenters. Among the things that I think are drawbacks to it, which I mentioned first. The first thing, which I did find really quite a frustrating UI element, is that you cannot, when you have the home screen, it's great, it's in portrait form, you then turn it on its side to look at something in landscape, and the home screen doesn't rotate. So if you've been watching something in landscape and you go out of that to go back to the home screen, you have to turn the tablet around. And it just seems a rather strange miss not to have that.
Have you just grown to accept that because you've used the iPad
The RIM Playbook does the same thing.
I
did actually compare the two.
Yeah.
Because the Playbook is the other 7-inch tablet that's got any traction at all, which is not a great deal, to be honest, because we have another Kindle Fire over here in the UK. Kindle Fire has sold quite well in the US. People who've compared the two say that the Nexus 7 is better than the Kindle Fire in terms of performance. Maybe, I don't know, because I've not seeing the Kindle Fire.
I'm assuming it's a sort of typical tablet. It's a touchscreen thing. You can look at pictures. You can look at videos. You can answer your emails.
You can answer your emails. Yeah, it doesn't have any 3G capability. So it doesn't have any phone capability as such. It's Wi-Fi only. No 3G options on the table. 8 gigabytes or 16 gigabytes. And 8 gigabytes. You're talking about a comparatively small amount of storage. Once you start getting some emails in there, once you start having a few apps, once you start putting some music on there, the Google Play film store in the UK has, I counted hundreds of films before I got bored of scrolling. It's not a bad selection. But the indication seems to be that the assumption behind the device seems to be that you will be in Wi-Fi places, or else that you're going to be somewhere where you can easily add some storage off your computer, because you can't do USB on the go. There's no SD card slot. There's no way of just adding a USB stick to it, which is unusual. Given that Android's strength over Apple products has been, hey, it's expandable. Hey, you can put an SD slot in. The iPad is very much a closed sort of device. You can sort of put a camera on and add pictures off a camera straight to it. But This, for example, doesn't have HDMI out, whereas lots of other larger tablets, even in fact the Playbook, has HDMI out. So there's lots of elements. I would say that the one thing that it does have going for it over the Playbook, which, you know, where the Playbook has other sorts of things that are going, like HDMI out, is the content. You know, simply that there are tons more apps for it. People probably already have a Google account that they can use to sign in with. And, you know, there's content on the Google Play Store if you want to buy films from there. Sorry, when I say buy films, I mean rent films.
In terms of, one of the things that struck me in the review that you wrote is that you specifically put this in the content consumption department. This is not something where you would, as you say, you know, write documents and you know, edit spreadsheets. But would you say that other tablets are for that? Most tablets are consumption devices, aren't they?
Harry McCracken of Technologizer did a really good post the other day where he said all computers are in some way a compromised content, you know, creation device. There's always some way in which they're not quite right. You know, it's only a question of degree. You know, that PC on your desk, well, you know, the keyboard's not so great if you're trying to draw something, is it? You know, so I think it is a matter of degree. You know, a 10-inch tablet is better for getting content in than a 7-inch one. It's just pretty hard because once you start having a screen on the device screen, you're starting to lose so much of the screen already to the keypad that it just becomes, you know, impossible to do anything useful. Mm. So you know, it really did look to me like something you'd be doing consumption with far more than you would be doing creation.
People seem to give the Apple devices a little bit more slack because it's almost as if they expect them to iterate. You know, it's like, okay, well, we've come out with this device. It's an innovation in and of itself, but, you know, it's limited. And so people expect, say, with, you know, iPad 1, iPad 2, they expect there to be some kind of advance. Mm. And so they're kind of like, okay, right, I'll wait for the next one, or I know that the next iteration is going to be something amazing. Do other companies, like Google, with this example, do other companies get as much slack, or are they expected to have the final product the first time around, unlike Apple?
Part of the reason that Apple has this expectation, or people build this expectation of iteration around Apple, is because they've seen it do it so many times. So with the iPod, you know, the 2001 version, people went, that's really $399, you get 5 gigs? That's pretty rubbish. But they iterated it. They did another one, had more storage, it was a bit cheaper, and then they cut the price, they kept on doing it. And then they split the range, then they had the iPod Mini. Then they killed off the Mini and they had the iPod Nano, and now you've got the video one, you've got the music one, you've got the iPod Touch. You know, they've just sort of produced all these different versions. They were doing the same at the same time with the iMac, you know, where they were doing one which was one colour, and they were doing a different colour, and they're doing lots of colours, and then they're doing things with CD burners and blah, blah, blah. So people have seen Apple do this, and, you know, they know that the product that they do is not the end point. It's just the start. You know, same with the iPad, you know, where they started in 2010 with the first iPad and everyone went, yeah, okay, that's not bad. But it, you know, in retrospect, you go, it's a bit shabby, isn't it? Now with Google, we don't know. It may be that the next iteration is going to be incredible, but we've not seen what they do. You know, it's quite hard. You have to be really determined if you're in the hardware business. You have to be really focused on the supply chain. You've got to be really focused on what are the elements which we can improve, what are the elements that actually need improving, you know, and that's not easy. And for Google to be trying to get into the hardware business, even though it's got Asus as its manufacturer here, and there's lots of talk about, you know, the cooperation between the two, Google and Asus do not, you know, they don't own each other. They've not got any shares in each other. So, you know, Asus could at some point just say, well, you know, it was nice, now we're going to go. Bye. And where does that leave the Nexus 7? Is it an orphan, or will they get Samsung to make the next one? It's a bit of a difficult question. You know, if you look at Android phones, the Google Nexus 1 was made by Motorola. The Nexus S, which was the one that came after that, made by Samsung. And then you have a one after, you know, then they went to Samsung again. But you can never be quite sure what is going to be the flagship. Where does this phone go? Or has it been orphaned? So there's a difference in approach. Because Apple owns the whole stack, you know that they're going to keep on iterating it because it's in their interests. With Google, you're not quite sure.
However, you can find out more on the Nexus tablet at guardian.co.uk/technology. Twelve years ago this week, Channel 4 broadcast The eMillionaire Show, their effort to enthuse British entrepreneurs to create the next killer app for the shiny and exciting World Wide Web. Since that time, we've seen the bubble burst and the evolution of the web from version 1 to version 2. We've also seen the emergence of Silicon Roundabout, the area of London near Old Street where many of the UK's modern-day e-entrepreneurs have set up shop to make their digital dreams come true. These are kids ripe for the picking, if only they had some capital. Enter the £1 million Startup Prize, launched last week by Digital Shoreditch, which takes a spoonful of eMillionaire and mixes it up with Dragon's Den and X Factor, and, for the lucky winners, delivers a cool million. Charles, what is it?
Well, it is sort of what it says on the tin a bit. It's it's trying to find a technology company, and it could be any technology, not just internet type technologies, from anywhere in the world. Although the condition is that they have to relocate to London, and they will be judged next year, or just before Digital Shoreditch, which is in May of 2013.
And that's an event.
It's a sort of a big. Big event where everyone gets together and says, "Hey, it's Shoreditch, it's digital," and you know that's what they're up to. They're trying to sort of, it's a bit like the eMillionaire Show, except not during the dot-com bust, we hope, and without the sort of excruciatingness of television. I mean, it's interesting, you know, looking back at the eMillionaire Show when there were two winners, each of whom got £1 million. Of prize money. One of the sites has gone dark, and the other one is basically just a sort of Drupal forum or something. It's really, it's sort of still going, but it's not what you would say is really £1 million worth of going.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that fondly because it was so ridiculous. It was absolutely.
Did you enter?
I didn't, of course not. I don't have any clever ideas. I just like watching other people's clever ideas. I mean, I found the whole thing fascinating because you could tell that Jon Snow, you know, he of Twitter, he's very good on Twitter and really engaged with the web, didn't really have any idea of what was going on. In fact, they were kind of like, what is this internet thing? Like, it was fascinating.
Everyone was like that in 2000.
Exactly. I remember the ideas that were thrown forward into this were very simple and actually quite quite restricted views of what was possible, versus something like Dragon's Den, where you get everything from, stand-up cat litter trays to, you know, chili sauce to all kinds of really quite mad ideas. This kind of event, competition, do you think now that we've had two decades of the web, people will be a little bit more, exploratory and do things that are quite way out there? Or do you think ultimately we're going to have some sort of moderate, mediocre, here's yet another Instagram clone, another social network, another 3D.
It's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, the sort of the ideal would be for someone to come along who is the next Mike Lynch. You know, Mike Lynch, who created Autonomy, which was a spin out from Cambridge University project and looking at the Bayes theorem, and he realized it could be applied to sorting through data. That's the sort of thing you would really want to see. It'd be interesting if they could actually get Mike Lynch to be, you know, in some way a mentor or a judge or whatever in this, because I think he's one of the smartest people and the best business people, you know, in the technology sector to have come out of the UK in a long time.
But Charles, is that sexy enough? I mean, I don't know, because I don't know who's on the judging panel. I don't know what kinds of criteria they're going to be looking for, given that this is... in some way to promote the event Digital Shoreditch. I don't know if they're going to want something that is shiny and not something that is an absolutely essential component for what happens behind the scenes.
Well, you've got to say that $10 billion, which is what Autonomy was sold for, that's sort of, you know, it's like Justin Timberlake in Social Network, isn't it? You know, I'll tell you what's sexy, it's $1 billion. And also, given that this is £1 million coming from, you know, backers, you would also think that they might want to see some sort of return on the million, that they're not just, you know, throwing it off to say, hey, look at the new shiny thing.
So it's not a consortium, it's a...
The precise source of the money has not been revealed, but as I understand it, it is sort of in there.
Why does this exist? I mean, I don't actually know of any other competitions like this, and I may just simply be ignorant of them, but I don't know of any other competitions like this in any other digital network, digital arena. The oft-lauded Silicon Valley model is replete with VCs and angel investors, whereas the UK seems to need something like this kind of injection.
But it's partly to get people excited by the idea. I mean, in Silicon Valley, the idea of a million-dollar startup, you'd be like, yeah, that happens every day. You know, someone gets $1 million from a VC, that's pretty much a currency you can count on happening at any point. But for the UK, getting VCs and, you know, venture capitalists, private equity, angel backers, getting all those sorts of people interested in getting them actually just coming around and in the X Factor style, looking at people. Because, you know, don't forget the thing with the X Factor, which is part of what this is trying to mimic, but in a tech startup way. With the X Factor, often the winner is not necessarily the one who goes on to have the great success. It's all the other people who you see through the show who turn out to have more personality, more flexibility, and actually more appeal. And it may be that the idea that does win won't be the one that has the most longevity, and actually something else that someone or some people come up with will be the really useful idea that in the end turns out to have great long-term value.
And we don't yet know who the judges are, do we?
We're not yet clear on the judges, but we're going to keep up to date with it.
Yeah. Well, you can find out more information at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, if you are hoping to create the next Angry Birds or Minecraft, there was only one place to be last week, and that was in my old manor, Brighton, here in the UK, because that is where the Develop Conference took place, a gathering of big and small games developers. And for The Guardian, our games blogger Keith Stewart went along, and he was joined by Christian Donlan, a freelance games journalist. He writes for Eurogamer, amongst others. But before we hear Keith and Christian give us a roundup of the festival, let's first listen to Keith talking to games tycoon Dave Perry, who was recently a hot topic after selling his cloud-based games company Gaikai to Sony for a reported $380 million. You're right, Charles. 1 million suddenly pales in comparison. But anyway, moving on. Dave is a legend in the games industry and has been a vociferous advocate for cloud gaming and its role in the future of the industry. Keith started out by asking Dave, what is his key insight into the future of gaming in the cloud?
I think time turns out to be the most important thing. And the reason I say that is because when you look at free-to-play, for example, the number one item that is always sold in every game is time. So when you look, meaning you can level up faster, and somehow it's saving one click is now, that used to be 4 clicks, is now 1 click. Anything that saves time, people tend to pay for the most. Everywhere, MP3s, whatever it is, digital video cameras, digital photography, I kept seeing this sort of theme of convenience and time. It seems to be this nitrous that gets added to anything. And so you go, well, what's the convenience and time version of the game industry? Meaning my time is really valuable and don't waste a second of it. And make it really easy for me too. That's where, again, if you just, with all the noise that's going on any platform, if you can deliver convenience and time, and then if you want to add some extra stuff, you start to look at price. Can we bring the price down too? That would be really nice. Then you can have convenience and also this lower cost. And so that's why an idea, you might have 100 ideas, but you can quickly filter down to the one that you think will actually move the needle the most. And that's what really helped us, I think, in just avoiding all the possible noise.
I can definitely see that happening with casual games and smartphone games, that whole time factor. I guess what hardcore gamers are sort of concerned about, especially obviously now that Sony is attached to a cloud platform, is, okay, what happens to the big AAA games that I love, the really, really deep games that I love? Do I want to be living in a future where I'm playing Uncharted and suddenly microtransactions come up at me? Am I facing a future where games have changed beyond the games I loved and have gone more towards the games that, you know, no one wants to swap Uncharted for Farmville,
right?
In the hardcore.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, so I want to be very clear. I mean, I'm a hardcore gamer, have always been, so, you know, trust me, we're not out to do anything evil or weird to gaming. Trust me on this. And there's a certain amount of people that will never want to play from the cloud. They will tell you very clearly it's not interesting to them. They just want to play locally on their own hardware. And I I totally agree with that intention until the day when something is in the cloud that's better than they have local. And then all bets are off, right? So the day that they get up and there's a game that's using four video cards in the cloud and they've only got one in their house, and they go, God, it looks awfully good. It does look awfully good. And then they might just go, I'll just check it out. The minute they do that, I think we'll be there. And so it's not that we need everyone now. We don't need everyone. Those hardcore guys that just have to own the disk and have to play it locally, my expectation is that it will allow them to try more games. So they'll be able to, you know, a game came out at 9 o'clock this morning, and they're casually interested in it. They don't have to go through the full buy or download install cycle. They can just click and try it, and they'll have an opinion on it. And maybe they'll like it, in which case they can install it on their killer rig at home, right? Mm-hmm. So that, I think my point is that it's for the really casual people who wouldn't have gone and done the whole buy and install. It'll get them in, but it will also, I think it'll slowly the super hardcore guys will become more and more interested.
So that was me talking to Dave Perry from Gaikai, who has just sold his company to Sony for $380 million. And Christian, I think, is it mostly thought that this is going to arrive on PlayStation 4, or do you think that we may see cloud-based gaming on PlayStation 3? I'm not quite sure what Sony are doing.
That is an interesting question. Obviously, there is the first question of whether Sony ever really knows what it's doing when it buys something. It tends to sort of feel its way towards things. It's clearly going to be a key part of what PlayStation 4 is. The question, and I think you will probably see little elements of it slipping out into PlayStation 3. The idea of streaming demos, for example, sounds like a pretty good way of testing it, just sort of doing stress testing while delivering something that people find interesting and exciting.
Moving on from Dave Perry, I saw another famous David at the show at Develop. It was David Braben, the creator of the famous BBC Micro game Elite way back in 1984. He's now the head of Frontier Developments. They're doing lots of games. They've got a great game out called Lost Winds on iOS. But he's also one of the founders of the charity Raspberry Pi, which has developed a very, very cheap, very, very small PC computer, which Raspberry Pi launched to developers at the end of February and are looking to get out to a wider user base through this year. They have manufacturing deals now with a couple of big manufacturers. They're looking to roll them out. It's been hugely successful, I think, much, much more successful than they were expecting. I think they were expecting to produce something like 10,000 units, and very quickly, when those were made available to developers at the end of February, orders massively exceeded that. I think they're going to sell in the hundreds of thousands. So at Develop, I spoke to David Braben, and we started by talking about the genesis of the whole Raspberry Pi idea and the fact that it came about because for this very long stretch from the late 90s onwards, children in schools were being taught, instead of computer science, which was dropped from the national curriculum, they were learning about ICT. So essentially, they were sitting in classrooms doing PowerPoint presentations and Excel documents, which I can't imagine a more soulless way of encountering technology. So I think this really was the genesis of Raspberry Pi. And here's David telling us all about it.
Because of the problems of space on the national curriculum, it wasn't practical to teach computer science alongside ICT. There just wasn't room. And so computer science died, which in turn killed off computer science at A level. And really problematically, and this is sort of where I came in, it killed off university applications. And it was looking into the cause of that problem that certainly led me to ICT and led me to meet some of the other people who are now part of Raspberry Pi, who came at it from the educational point of view and how to solve the problem.
Okay. So what comes on? So now it's been released. If I bought a Raspberry Pi, I hooked it into my monitor, switched it on, I guess it's a Linux OS, a Linux-based OS, but what else is on there that's going to help me learn to program?
Well, everything there is free. You can download different distributions. There's nothing to stop other people out there creating new things. I believe someone out there has done RISC OS. You know, we've suggested Linux as a starting point because that's what we got off the ground with. With the educational release, we're looking at building layers of software on top of it where we can do things, something like BBC Basic, to help for self-learning, so it's really simple. And I think Linux is a bit daunting.
Yeah.
You know, particularly setting up an SD card to boot and downloading everything. And at the moment, I think, to be fair, it probably needs a computer just to set up the SD card. So it's sort of not there yet. But in some ways it is, because we've engaged so many kids.
Yeah, yeah. So I presume, are you hoping that they learn how to program C and use a compiler themselves? Or I think you mentioned in your talk that you're implementing Scratch, which is MIT's drag and drop programming tool.
Yeah. Scratch is on there now. Mm. I'm not after any particular objective like people learning C. What I want to see is people being more creative, more engaged. I'd love to see more girls being engaged with programming. Because I think there are challenges there, particularly about the way it's taught and the way people are encouraged to play with computers. It's seen as a very boyish thing. It's a bit like cars. So I think there are lots of objectives going forward. It's not really just that people learn programming. They learn to be creative and create things of their own. It might be 3D art. It might be music. You know, it's to try and give tools so that people can look at the problem in a different way and have something that's theirs. You know, we in the South, the rich sort of Southeast, assume everyone has a computer at home. But actually, that's not quite the case. And what's worse is those who do, the parents really don't like the kid messing the computer up. I wouldn't mess around with my own computer at the sort of low level unless I really knew what I was doing. So I think that's also partly it. If it's the kids, and it doesn't really matter if they destroy it, that's a very, very positive thing.
So that was David Braben on Raspberry Pi. He says in the next through the next year, I think it's planned for Q4, they're going to release a new version of Raspberry Pi, actually in a case, because at the moment it's just it's basically a PCB board with a USB port sticking out of it. And they're also going to run a competition for under-18s in full-time education with a $1,000 first prize to use Raspberry Pi in a creative way. So they're really trying to engage with children, I think. I don't know about you, Christian, but when I was at school, I was in the computer club.
We didn't have a computer club at my
really?
School. No, we had a... It was badger baiting.
Maybe. Right, fine. But it's a good thing, isn't it? Because a lot of the the games that we remember from being kids were created by people that had probably grown up on BBC and ZX81, and we lost that for a while.
My worry about Raspberry Pi, and I think it's really exciting and I'm totally in favour of it, my worry is still knowing what I was like as a kid, that I was stupid and lazy. What happens when you plug Raspberry Pi in? What do you see? Because if you look at... it reminds me a little bit of the App Store in that loads of people were trying to get people to buy digital content online and pay for content, whether it was songs or whether it was music or whether it was certainly games online. And what Apple did was the service was there, but they nailed the interface. And I think there needs to be they need to work out how to create an interface which at least eases you into the process of creating games.
The interesting thing about it, though, is I think if you can catch children before they get to the lazy part and stupid part, which is what I did. I mean, when I was in school, when I was 8 or 9, I was in physics club, maths club, computer club. I was a real catch.
Were you graduating?
Yeah, no, I wasn't. But but after that, you know, when I got to my teens and I discovered Prince and breakdancing, that was it. So yeah,
this is going in a very scary direction. I totally agree, though. It's really exciting, and that taking down that barrier. He's so right. You think everyone has a PC, but in fact, and the idea that giving kids something they can't destroy is really a wonderful start.
We also met, I also met Ian Livingston at Develop. Ian's a 25, 30 year games industry veteran. He started out, his company imported the first Dungeons & Dragons board games, the original board games from the States. And he set up Games Workshop, he set up their magazine White Dwarf, and then he got into video games during the early 80s with a company called Domark, and he was very active in games then, and now he's the life president of Square Enix, the Tomb Raider publisher. He was at Develop, and he's very much behind this whole idea of making computing accessible to children at schools. He's been very vocal. He's been lobbying the government. He's been one of the paramount forces in getting Michael Gove to get computer science back into schools. And he talked really about this whole idea of computing being much more commonplace, programming being much more commonplace in the 80s. And we spoke about that. And he had some advice on Michael Gove as well.
It's strange that we were doing coding back in the day. In the 1980s, the BBC Micro was a cornerstone of computing in schools and in the homes. The Spectrum, as you quite rightly say, was an affordable programmable computer. And all that got lost over time as computers got locked down and people were worried that you're going to break my computer or you're going to ruin the network. And so children were simply allowed to use technology but had no insight in how to create technology. So there's various initiatives going on, like of course the Raspberry Pi initiative. Here's an affordable £22 programmable computer with a Linux operating system, a 256 meg of RAM, and a video quality of the iPhone. For £15 million out of an extraordinarily large educational budget that exists today, you could give each and every child in this country a Raspberry Pi. And whilst not all of those are going to survive, some will be lost, some will be broken, I would hope and would predict that enough children would be excited by the possibilities of creating technology and then working in teams, artists and programmers together, creating content for the digital world in which we are living in today and drive the British economy going forward.
So now you're talking to Michael Gove. Have you got any sort of key ideas for him in terms of integrating computers more readily into schools? And
this might sound a bit odd, but I hear that he wants to give each child a King James Bible. Now, for about the same amount of money, might I suggest that he gives each and every child a Raspberry Pi so they can actually download the Bible for free and carry it around them and do other things as well as read the Bible?
So Ian Livingston there, and I suspect that when teenagers are given access to a free internet-capable PC, the first thing they are going to download is the King James Bible. I'm absolutely certain of that. The interesting thing there was this idea of the democracy of creation on computers. Now, the fact that we are in some ways back to that period in the early 80s where you've got two or three guys around a computer programming games together. And in some ways, the modern digital distribution for games and the iPhone game, smartphone development, development on the PC-based digital distribution medium called Steam, both of these things have allowed a new generation of smart, young games developers to get their games out there in small teams again and distribute them globally. But a key problem with this is, I think Christian, you might agree, it developed one of the key themes was discoverability. The fact that, well, now we're all in that stage again where all of us can create games in small teams, but no one can find them. I mean, the App Store is an absolute nightmare for finding games. So is Steam in some ways. So is the Android market. Did you find that a developer? That seemed to be what a lot of the developers were saying. How do we get people to find our games?
Yeah, this has certainly been something which appears to have been brewing over the last couple of years. And it is part and parcel of that kind of democratization. When you allow everyone to make a game, everyone does make a game. And then it's much harder to get to the good stuff. What's interesting, I think, it struck me just then listening to Ian Livingston talking about this, is that wherever you go around the world, you'll always see English people working in game design studios. English, you know, Richard LeMarchand was head of he was the creative director on Uncharted 3, I think. And you just see people everywhere, English people everywhere. The problem isn't getting, just to go back to that point, because I think they're both tied in together, the idea of getting good English design graduates or computer graduates has never been a problem. The problem is that they go elsewhere because England now has no publishers. And Ian Livingston should know because he sold basically the last one. And publishers solve, in a part, I mean, they do a lot of things which are terrible and they do a lot of things which people don't like and they do a lot of things which people do like but they don't notice because they're invisible. But one of the things publishers did do is they help get you through that visibility problem a bit. You see, like, a lot of the top selling apps are published by Chillingo, which is EA's, who were bought by EA. And a publisher is certainly a route to cut through that. It's probably not always the best route. In fact, a lot of the game designers I've spoken to at iOS on iOS say don't go with a publisher because they don't yet totally understand in the marketplace, so they're not providing the service they should be serving. Mm. But that is still an interesting part of the deal.
I mean, there's a whole argument at the moment about whether you should self-publish and control everything and make sure you retain rights to the IP. But then there is an argument. I mean, there's this whole new strata of almost virtual publishers, which has cropped up. People like companies like Appy Nation, Chillingo, who aren't the massive global megaliths like EA and Activision, and they have a specialism in digital distribution.
Discovery is still a big problem. The idea that there are games out there which are so brilliant and which you are missing. So last point on this, I promise. I went to see the Drop7 developers who've now been bought by Zynga, which is very interesting, Area Code in New York. Drop7 is probably, I would say, it's a ridiculous thing to say, but if Tetris is the best puzzle game ever, Drop7 is probably the second best puzzle game ever made. And I went there and I was talking with them and I was saying, it must be great for you guys. You must be rich now and driving around in gold cars and eating lobster Thermidor every night. And they were saying, no, we've sold about 100,000 copies. And that's a magnificent game. Everyone who plays it loves it. And it didn't manage to punch through the barrier of to become a public thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. What came out of Develop for me very much, and there were so many sessions about how you get your game discovered, but fundamentally, what you have to do is create an astonishingly good game. Again, but not just a widely good game like Tetris, but a game like Minecraft that speaks to a very specific community in a very specific way. And I think one of the people I met at Develop was Simon Reed, who created New Star Soccer. Which is this strange hybrid of a playable soccer game and a management game tied into one, and you control a player through his career, and not only do you play on the pitch, but you also control his love life and his business life. And Simon has been working on this game on PC for several years, and he's been through, I think, five or six versions of this game. Earlier this year, he brought out an iOS version of the game. And it has skyrocketed. It was an enormous, enormous success. And again, because I think, like what Minecraft did, is it tapped into something that lots of people wanted to play without never realizing that there was games out there like it, and it was something they wanted to do. I mean, how would you address the success of New Star Soccer?
The financial success of New Star Soccer is very hard to work out why that particular game came through, especially since it has practically no graphics and it is a lot of text. And I think in terms of why it's satisfying to play, it's much easier in that Elmore Leonard famously said that to write his books, he just leaves out all of the boring details, and this is football with all of the boring details left out. The games auto scroll, and then you get to the point where someone kicks the ball to you, and then that's the bit you play. And that is such an elegant idea. Slicing away all the things in the world which aren't precisely to do with you is a really good way of making a game. And also the whole bringing in, combining management of on the field and the whole circus of being a footballer is a really beautiful idea.
So I met Simon at Develop, and he told us a little bit about how he got started with New Star Soccer. And it's one of those kind of nice Hollywood style stories, because he was possibly in the most inauspicious place you could begin a career in games development.
Around about 2005-2006, I was working on IT help desk. I would have long periods of doing nothing overnight, because it was a night shift. So I'd take my laptop in, work on New Star Soccer. It was around about New Star Soccer 3 at the time. And then when I launched it, it was doing quite well. So I thought, now's the time to go completely, you know, full indie and see if I can survive.
What do you think kicked it off? What happened to... Because what traditionally happens with iPhone games is they just... At some point, there's this tipping point where suddenly it goes viral. What was that point for you?
I wasn't getting any reviews. You know, they weren't happening. And then Simon Byron did me a press release. Suddenly, EdgeMag picked up on it.
He's the head of PR, a big premier PR company. Yeah.
He just said, I want to do that for free, you know, because I love the game. So I was like, of course, yeah, go for it. And then some reviews started to flow. And I guess it didn't have a massive impact on sales, but there just seemed to be this groundswell until the Sun newspaper reviewed the game. Obviously a great audience for a football game. And overnight, sales virtually tripled. That catapulted it up to the sort of top 20 grossing games on the App Store. But from there, it just seemed to sort of just build and build. And Twitter was a huge factor. I think loads of people tweeting about their stats, their careers. And at that point, it did sort of just tip and go viral. And eventually, it hit the number one spot and hovered around there for a few days. And now it's sort of still top 10. So,
how many downloads have you done of the game?
It's approaching 900,000. So I'm hoping for the million in the next few weeks or months, I'm not sure, yeah.
Yeah. And if you, we're at a Develop conference at the moment, and there's lots and lots of young developers here, lots of students, lots of people that are developing their first iPhone games, and everyone's kind of looking for the secret, you know, the secret of making an iPhone game that does an Angry Birds or does a New Star Soccer. And do you think that really exists? Is there a kind of a business thing that you can do to up your chances of having a successful game on the App Store?
No, I don't think so, because I feel incredibly lucky. I mean, obviously, the game, as I say, I've been working on New Style Soccer for 10 years, so I've learned a lot and I've refined it. And, you know, I was very proud of the game and I was happy with it, but I didn't know that it would be successful. I guess after the success, you can say, well, I can put it down to this, this and this. But before that, I didn't know that that would work, these things would work. And I guess that's different for every successful game. You know, it's a football game that's done well, as opposed to, you know, Angry Birds or whatever. They're completely different. And they've got their own reasons for that success, I think. But one of the key things, I guess, is if you're going to make an iPhone game, then absolutely target the device's key features, like, you know, it's a touch screen, so don't put an on-screen joystick on there. things like that, just a simple, you know, make sure it's, you're not just using old methods for a new system, you know, new device, I guess.
That was Simon Reed talking about the success of his game, New Star Soccer, which was at number one on the App Store for ages and ages, and I think the daily revenue it was bringing in was quite astounding. I won't go into figures, I don't want to embarrass Simon, but I think he's done quite well out of it. Yeah, and I think his only real advice there for the makers of Drop 7 was get your game reviewed in the Sun. I think that's pretty much it, wasn't it?
Yeah. Meeting him at the event, there was another thing which did strike me about him was how he is not part of the industry, and that may actually have, in a weird, counterintuitive way, may have a lot to do with his success. I've just been reading a book by Jack Hitt, who's a This American Life contributor at the moment, and he's written a book about the importance of amateur movements in America, how sort of amateurs sit outside of the professional environments, and sometimes they see things which professionals don't. And a lot of develop conference, a lot of the talks are about, don't do this anymore. We've realized this thing doesn't work anymore, so don't try doing that anymore and do this thing instead. And I think Simon, being outside of games and not knowing the things that you're meant to do and the things you're not meant to do, he created a game which is just very different. And that is what made it successful. He feels almost like a Galapagos Island developer a little bit. So yeah. This separate evolution has led to this very strange game, which everyone turns out to love.
So finally, Christian, we were both there for 3 days. Was it a good experience for you? What was your highlights, or what did you take from it?
Develop is always a really good experience in an interesting way, in that GDC starts at the beginning of the year in America and you get everyone when they're very excited. They've got these new ideas. That's the Game Developer Conference. They've got new ideas. They're very excited to try them out. And it's in San Francisco and they're all, you know, very, very excited about life. By Develop, it's generally a windy July in Brighton and the grey wash is coming off the sea and everyone is miserable. But you do get to see what developers are afraid of next. And several years ago, it was iPhone, and then it was Facebook, and now at the moment it's freemium. These things which are opportunities, which are so gigantic that they are in some way terrifying. And it's always interesting when you ask people to predict the things they think are going to be big, you get a load of different stuff, and a lot of it doesn't hit the mark. But every time you go to develop and you ask people what they're afraid of, that's always the next big trend.
Maybe that's why Dave Perry's been turning up so much. Because a few years ago, everyone said they were terrified of cloud gaming, and he went off and built a $380 million business out of it.
He is very tall. He's physically imposing, so that's scary as well.
He's the only person I've ever interviewed that's taller than me, which is terrifying. And lastly, smart TVs. There were like five talks on smart TVs and how they could be the future of gaming, and how in the future we're all going to be sitting with a tablet on our laps playing quiz shows, except there'll be no contestants on the screen. It'll be us that are competing. That's the future, Christian.
The future is they finally found a way to sell us another television.
Thanks to Keith Stewart and Christian Donlan. And we'll be putting out the interviews that Keith gathered at this year's Develop over the next couple of weeks as Tech Weekly extras. So keep a beady eye on our feed for that. And remember, you can keep up with Tech Weekly on Twitter. That's @GuardianTW. And the Guardian technology feed is @GuardianTech. All these stories are on guardian.co.uk/technology. That is it for us this week. Many thanks, Charles, and to our special guests, Keith and Christian. You can read more on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology and keep up with the latest headlines throughout the week. I'm Alex Kratowski. The producer this week was Jason Phipps. And we're back next Tuesday. See you then.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service.
Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.